Greetings and welcome to the Creative Entrepreneur Podcast. I am your host, Pete Lorimer, former hit record producer and now host of the show Stay Here on Netflix and owner of LA's most creative boutique real estate firm, PLG Estates. On the podcast, you will always find business and real estate strategies, marketing techniques and tips for the entrepreneur. So hit that subscribe button. On today's podcast, we get to sit down with multi-platinum selling artist, songwriter, and producer, Dennis White, aka LaTroit, aka Static Revenger, aka Charm Farm. Dennis, who has worked with the likes of such industry giants as deadmau5, Kevin Saunderson from groundbreaking band Inner City, and culminating with his 2018 Grammy-winning work with Depeche Mode. I got a chance to sit down with my mate Dennis to find out what keeps his clock ticking as a creative entrepreneur and how he remains relevant and as fresh as he does after 30 years of making records. Plus, we will get the inside scoop on the winning of that Grammy too. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for some bonus tracks by the marvelous Mr. Dennis White. So without further ado, here it is, Dennis White as my guest on the Creative Entrepreneur Podcast. You won the Grammy for the Depeche Mode song You Move.
Thank you very much. I'm on stage with Paul Schaefer. Similar circumstances, and it was amazing. I'm just going to bite him right now. I'm here because hundreds of people over decades of time helped me. Many are in this room, many are not. There's going to be a full list of thank yous on my website tonight, but to everybody that ever thanked me, I'm here because you helped me. This is what happens when we help each other. This is why we have to help each other. Good things happen. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you.
All right. Now what?
So I have some questions.
Okay.
You thought you were going to ask me questions? That's adorable. So I'm here with Pete Lorimer.
Oh, God.
And Pete Lorimer I've known for decades. Pete is well known in the world of music, firstly, with like a lot of the really big name drops in the 90s in terms of production work, working with George Michael at some point and in excess. Had a very high-profile, noteworthy career as a dance music producer. Was the biggest remixer and dance music dude for many, many years. Billboard number ones, with 20 of them or something like that? Like, a lot. A little more, sorry. No offense. and, you know, Pete, at the height of what I would call his fame or his success, you know, usually the way this story goes is... dude either got bored in whatever he was doing or kind of couldn't really make it work or sense that it wasn't the... So now he's going to do something else. Real estate is a popular one around here. And I remember you had a number one record in the UK. It was a 29 Palms record, I think, right? And I was very excited. It was like, you made a lot of money on that record. It was a big success. I'm like, great, what's next? It's like, yeah, I'm going to get into real estate. What? You're what? And it's what I love about this. I mean, you did it on your own terms at the height of success in the music business, not when the people are planning their next record and their tour. And you're like, all right, nailed that. Going into real estate. And to see the way that you built that, because I've known you through this entire crossfade, the way that you built it up and built it up and built it up. To know you, I just honestly, sincerely, really, really proud of you. And I use you as an example countless times in just a large range of ways about the way that you can really switch your life up. The way that you can apply stuff that you knew earlier in your life to things that you might be doing later in life. So, for example, you told me one time, man, you know, stuff that is normal for us as musicians, record promotion, flyers, club or whatever, this is like eye-opening to people in real estate. They just don't think this way. So you went in there like, all right, where's the music video for this house? Right? It's been incredible to see the way that you've transformed that space. And I'm happy to be here talking to you about that because we have, you know, we hang out a lot, but we don't really talk about this, right? So it's fun to be able to talk to you about this. So what I'd like to know.
God, you've caught me completely off guard here, Dennis.
So let's talk about a little bit.
Shit.
Now, there has to have been a moment. Right now, it seems like it was easy and automatic. Of course, for three, Pete Lorimer, right? But it was no way was it that the whole time.
No.
It definitely wasn't.
No.
When you first decided to get into it, talk to us about your feelings. Talk to us about the emotion. You know, being in music is a very ego-connected, emotional, you know, it's like kind of defines who we are. Talk to me about what it was like to be able to let go of that and able to, you know, to embrace what was happening next, because it had to have been a challenge.
So for everybody who's hearing this, I am utterly blindsided by Dennis right now, who I love dearly. I'll go into, and you gave a really good synopsis. I've said that to people, you know, I got out the music business on top, and they all look at me like, sure you did, pal. What I felt, it's interesting. You and I have been in bands and making records for probably about the same amount of time. We were in bands from like 11, 12 on, right? And then music for me was my muse. It was my mistress. I fell in love with her, right? Mm. And then what happened was in it, I personally kind of got a little bit of an unhealthy lifestyle in there for a minute, for a number of years. And that in conjunction with discovering that you could rip from CDs, I was like, okay, I'm feeling like I need to make the jump into something else because my unhealthy lifestyle was going to continue and I know I needed to change that and I couldn't whilst I remained in nightclubs.
Yeah, I wasn't going to be the one to say all that, but well done for saying that.
And I knew it, you know, and to anybody out there, it's like if you're fighting, fuck it, I'm just going to say it. If you're fighting addiction, which I have been in recovery for almost 18 years now.
Well done to you.
And I knew I couldn't have sobriety and nightclubs.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them had to give.
Yeah.
And in conjunction with that, having, you know, a really good run and a really big hit at the end, and then a nice payday from one of those giant double-decker buses that roll in from London occasionally and dump a bunch of cash on your lawn.
A little something we like to call the good old days.
The good old days! And I'm like, okay. I'm like, the rope is over the wall. I'm going to jump. And I did feel that Los Angeles property was undervalued because my mom lived in England, my brother lived in Australia. And I was also dating, who you remember, a very difficult lady who also got into the same career. And I'm like, wow, this chick's a bitch. If she can do it, I can nail it. And so I got into it. And I will tell you, Dennis, coming off the back of all those hits, I shuffled into the back of my first real estate office. I didn't tell a soul what I did. I just sat at the back, started making notes, starting writing my goals, and I just kept my nose down and I just went for it. And I knew, very much like I knew I couldn't have sobriety in nightclubs, I knew I couldn't have music and an entrepreneurial career. I had to pick one lane and run really hard, but you know, a leopard can't change its spots. And here I am sitting in another recording studio doing creative shit.
But coming back from a completely different place in it, right? So like the music was the foundation of what you were before and you were doing music. Now it's not the foundation of what you're doing, which gives you the opportunity to do it completely at your pace and on your terms.
Correct.
And with no nightclubs.
With no nightclubs and with a little bit of Netflix thrown in there, which doesn't hurt.
Not a bad thing.
But ladies and gentlemen, this is not a Pete Lorimer podcast. This is actually, let me tell you, Dennis White. Dennis White is one of the most talented producers and songwriters and artists and entrepreneurs and all things creative. And your width, the parameters that you maneuver in, you go from banging house to hip hop to all sorts of genres to scoring. What was the, you did the end scoring on which huge animation?
I don't know.
Was it the Dracula movie?
Hotel
Transylvania.
You did Hotel Transylvania. I mean, you go from house music to Hotel Transylvania. What? And the name of this podcast is The Creative Entrepreneur, because there is a theme with all of the creatives who I still hang out with and I love, is this. You walk into a room in a morning or an afternoon, whenever it is, there is nothing in there but air, and you come out with a product. How do you do that?
Well, so for me, I'm just lucky that I was raised in that environment. I'm not magical. I just was lucky enough to be raised by Jack Bott, my grandfather, and Kathy White, my mother, and both of them were creative entrepreneurs. My grandfather was an inventor, okay? He invented shit, and if you called him an inventor, he would be really offended or annoyed. He thought, like, inventors are a bunch of, like, flakes. He was an inventor, but then what he was after that was a salesman, because he said, quite accurately, that you could have the greatest idea in the world, but until you get somebody to buy it or somebody cares about it, you have exactly zero. The greatest idea, the greatest song you ever wrote gets you to exactly zero. Now you got to get people to care about this, right? So he invented stuff that felt like he was in the auto industry. We're a Detroit-based family. He was an auto supplier, and he invented shit that you just wouldn't think needed to be invented. He invented the luggage rack. He has the patent for the luggage rack.
Get out of
town. His book of patents was like the King James Bible. It was
really?
Yeah. There were hundreds of those things in there, and he invented the license plate frame. What? Like, that needed to be invented.
That's patented?
It's a patent. It was like, nobody did it before. It's like, that needs a frame. And all kind of just random shit, right? So I was born into, he would have an idea, right? This is where I learned rights management in ownership first, right?
So he
was doing what he was doing, and then at age 40 did a crap deal, just like is very familiar to artists when we're kids. We do shit deals and sign over a bunch of shit we didn't mean to. Right. He did that when he was 40 and had kids and private club memberships, and he had to start from absolutely zero again. And his new model was, my idea, I am owning this shit. I'm not signing this off to anybody. So he just kept building up his catalog, building up his ideas, the stuff that he owned, his patents. For us, it's copyrights, right?
Yeah.
Now he's got this stuff, and he had a sales company, so he was the guy going out and selling this stuff, sell the accounts. Then he was like, wait a minute, I sold it now. Now I can either license this to, it's so similar to music, man. I can either license this to another company, I'll take a royalty, and they'll make more money because they're actually making it. Or I can figure out how to finance my own company, manufacture it myself. Now I'm making all this money, right?
Yeah.
So he did exactly that, right? So he had effectively his own record company now. This is the way that I was raised, just watching him kind of do that. And it was kind of ingrained in me.
Agreed. Now, obviously, he is a true entrepreneur. Textbook dictionary definition.
Yeah.
A creative entrepreneur is similar, but there is a marked difference. When you walk in a room, you sit down and create art.
No, check it out, though. The way that we fall asleep with like a notebook or a thing, so we wake up with our ideas and just get them down. He had a notebook the side of his bed. He would wake up with the most hairbrained. His version of songs was like, oh, my idea is this. Oh, shit. Okay. It's identical. Right. So he was a creative entrepreneur.
Beautiful way of putting it.
Is really the way that he was doing that.
I guess you're 100% right. I thought there was some kind of separation, but
not in his regard.
An idea is an idea.
Right.
Right. Something that has not existed before that now exists.
Right. My mom was the same way. She she invented little things. That wasn't really her game. What she did is she brought kind of like aerobic fitness to the States in the 70s. She was one of the first ones. Just before Jane Fonda kind of did that, she was part of that wave of stuff and kind of brought that in. And her approach to entrepreneurship and building that as a business was just like, I just watched her do it. And she just did it out of fucking thin air, right? It was amazing to watch her do it. And so I learned to spot the money around me and try to get in the middle of all that. So Gramps says, all right, you got a gig in this shitty little bar called Paychecks in Hamtramck, right? What are they going to pay? $50. All right, cool. So then how's that a business? How are they making money? Well, they sell tickets. All right. And how much are you getting out of that? I get $50. Okay, great. And they're selling drinks if you get people there? Yeah. Okay. And what about the sound system? Who owns that? I don't know. So what I learned from him, it's like, no, you're not going to go play at this little place for $50 because then you're stuck at $50. Find a room. Actually, the room was Paychex that I ended up finding. The first place wasn't that. And so I found this little room that had 9 people on a Saturday night. And I went in and it just talking mad shit. And I'm 19. And this is an old Polish bar owner. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, don't worry about it. We're going to get 100 people a night every Saturday night here. We want this from the bar. We want to, you're going to get this much from tickets and we're going to take, you know, the tickets were $5. We get 4, you get 1. Sound good? He's like, yeah, sounds good to me. Right. So that I was raised to just where is this? There's money all over the place. Where just find it. Turn $1 into 5. I was just raised in that. Music, for example, I was based in Detroit. I had a little major label rock band. We had half a little thing going on out there. Oh, you know, because you did a remix of that song and ruined our career. Thanks very much. I don't know if there's anywhere near enough time for that part of the story. That's a different podcast. That's the one I'm going to host.
Oh, that's a good story.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah, yes.
You know what? We might have to say it. We might have to. So I'll jump in. So I was hired with my partner Richard Uptivision to do a remix for you on your band Charm Farm.
Charm Farm, that's right.
No, I had no idea. No idea that Dennis was the lead singer, and he had a backup singer. And when we were doing the mix, I'm like, to Richard, we didn't know. We never met the band. I'm like, Richard, let's pull the guy out. Let's pull the guy out. The chick's got the great voice. Push her right up. And of course, it ended up being a really big hit.
It was a really big hit. And it had nothing to do with the band or me, more importantly to me. And So we had that going on. And that, well, you ruined our career, so I had to figure out something else to do. But like, quick life lesson here, though, in terms of adjustment. You guys did this kind of commercial dance music version of mm-hmm. that track. I was trying to will that project to be like a disco rock band kind of thing, but what it wanted to be was that. And so when I finally let go of whatever I thought I wanted it to be and just embrace what it actually was, that opened up the doors to what ended up being a massive career a handsome career for me in dance music.
It's an extremely,
right?
Listen, how many Grammy winners for dance music are there in the world? Less than a dozen, right? Anyway, you are one of them, but we're going to touch on that later. Dennis won the Grammy last year for an incredible remix of Depeche Mode, and your acceptance speech was absolutely beautiful and humble and just gorgeous, man. But we're gonna touch on that later.
So it came time. My major label career had run its course. And I also knew, like, I was friends with some of the Detroit guys. And I don't mean this in any disparaging way, but there was a band of note called Sponge that was a Detroit band at the time. And those guys were in their 40s at the time. And they had to go out and tour to make a living. And I was like, I do not want to be 45 on a tour bus in a rock band. Fuck that. Nothing. I don't mean to be disparaging. They were into it. That was their life. That was cool. It just wasn't for me. Right. I like to be more of a studio guy in the studio. So I spotted LA as one of these kind of places where you could turn a dollar into 5. So I had an experience with the major label where they had all the rights. I'm not going to say they screwed me over or anything, but it's like they had the rights and they kind of owned my ass and you can't do that much. Right. So the next thing I did, the next song was Happy People in my dance music career. That's sort of like the first breakout thing that I did. My model was, I am going to own this and I'm going to license it on. And in maintaining control of it and ownership of it, I was in a position to make a lot of money on that. And we did. I was just with Stephen Melrose just last night. We were talking about it.
Oh, funny. I saw him yesterday as well.
Okay. Yeah. Your name came up, actually. And so, you know, he was involved in that deal. And we were just like kind of like to the point of your deal earlier, just in the good old days, you just roll up a double-decker bus and just throw out a pile of pounds and then keep driving. Like, all right, cool.
How much?
Right.
Sure.
You know, and then so then to the point of creative entrepreneurship, that kind of stuff, there comes a point where the creative stuff, for me anyway, it doesn't feel creative because that's my base instinct. That's my natural thing, right? That stuff just comes naturally to me.
Yeah.
Where I do have to get pretty creative is on the entrepreneurial side. That's where I really flex my creativity. So in this way, these are how I've managed to sort of marry these things for as long as I have. And it was one really important thing that I, to the point of rights management, I would say that 80% of the money I make in a year is on music that I own the rights to or control the rights to that I couldn't fucking giveaway commercially.
Can
we talk about dollars here?
Like that's, money? Yeah, of course we can. And that's a really powerful point because there's a lot of people who are going to be watching this who maybe have a YouTube channel or an indie label and they think, I mean, I think it's changing, but the old model of do a demo, send it into a label, get a record deal, get a publishing deal, that isn't the roadmap anymore.
No,
and you lead the charge on that and always have. Yeah, please talk on that.
Yeah, so for example, there was a song that I co-wrote with Amy Mariello and Richard Harris, two very talented songwriters, and it was called, whatever it was called, Break Me Off, or something like that, right? And it was, this maybe 10 years ago, it was a big David Guetta-ish dance music hitty kind of thing, and it was great, it was massive. And I went, you know, running around town, Cher likes it, Madonna likes it, and it's all bullshit, but this is what you, the feedback you get back, you know? At the end of the day, no one liked it, nothing happened with it. We could not give this song away, right? Well, somehow Tyler Perry hears it.
Ooh.
It ends up being the closing theme to whatever his thing is. We made 40 grand on that. Couldn't give it away. Made 40 grand on it for a song that was commercially worthless, right? Forgetting the dollar amounts now, the most money I made in the last year were two songs that were good songs. And what I do with these things is I own them and I control them. So every 2 years, I do new versions to kind of spruce it up, bring it up to market, kind of like in real estate.
Sure.
The way you want to like make it look the way that it should this
sure.
year.
You pretty up for sale.
Right, exactly. Prettied up for sale. That's exactly what I do with these songs. I don't think about doing that for myself. Pretty up for sale.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're kind of pretty. You're pretty enough.
And these two songs, I made my whole year off of these two songs that one of them had 1,000 streams on Spotify and one of them wasn't even on Spotify, right? So that's rights management, ownership, and just having an appreciation. If nothing happened, if the shit didn't happen to your idea or your thing the way you were aiming, don't let that close you down from the other stuff that might work for it.
Yeah.
So that's been huge for me.
So essentially treating your creativity as a business is a theme that I'm hearing throughout this. And one thing that I learned the hard way was through management. And when I was a young 18-year-old record producer, I had a big manager sign me in London. I'm like, great, I never need to find gigs anymore. And I never need to manage my business. And then I kind of, 3 years later, I'm like, damn, I'm getting all the gigs. I'm negotiating the deals and they're just taking their 20%. So it was a hard lesson. And to people out there, collaboration is a wonderful, wonderful thing. But my feeling with collaboration is never collaborate unless you feel you both bring something significant to the party. Meaning, if you're a young artist and you don't know the business world, don't sign to a manager out of desperation for not having one. Learn that shit. Go on YouTube, speak to other people, read books. Don't be naive because it
dude,
can
100%.
Be
there's this idea, everyone, I'm over it now, but all of us when we were kids had this idea, we'll get a manager and then they do everything.
Right.
No, they do not. Just wrap your head around the fact that you will never meet anyone in your life unless you marry them who's going to be as invested in you and your career as you are. It's just not going to happen. And I was telling this story just 2 days ago. I don't mean to be disparaging to anybody, but it was a simple fact of nature that when I was young, I signed a production deal to a fair guy, right? But I was in Detroit. I was a young kid. This is early 90s, okay? So I'm 23, 4, whatever. And I'm smart enough to at least know that I am not smart and just get a real lawyer to do this. I hired a real lawyer. It cost me a lot of money. And he negotiated the deal. I was like, yes, okay, cool. Later, the record that we were talking about, the Charm Farm record, mm-hmm. that ended up with, I think, a $450,000 offer from Mercury. And the label, the production label I was signed to, well, they own that record. So the deal was between Mercury and the label. And the label said, we'll break you off another 25 grand if you sign this inducement letter. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Third party licensing, even I know that is 50-50, man. And he said, what are you talking about? Well, that's not like read the contract. The lawyer, when I called him up and said, what's going on here? And he said, no, that's crazy. That's crazy. I know. For a fact, I wrote the contract and it says that the licensor does not have the right to license this on without. Okay. He looked at the contract. He called me back horrified and I was too young to make a big fuss about it. The word not was not in the sentence.
Oh, no.
So it said licensor shall have the right to license this on to whoever he wants. The word not was not. It was just that one conjunction. And that was like a $425,000 mistake. Well, I guess it would have been 200 grand to me. But anyway, at that point.
That was a lot of dough.
At that point, I was like, fuck all y'all. I'm going to be a micromanaging bitch, and I'm going to learn every single fucking thing, and I'm going to be a pain in everyone's ass. So I was too much of a pain in everybody's ass, and I learned to rein that back a little bit. But the point is, even, you know, I have a publishing company and an artist development company, and I sign a lot of young artists, but I have a passion for making sure that these little rascals do not end up in a shitty deal. And I talk them through every line, whether they want to hear it or not. They don't. They just want to sign it, move on with their lives. I'm like, no, you're lucky it's me, because it might not have been me. And, you know, and I just make sure that they leave. I don't know why I take that upon myself as a mentor. I really try to educate my young artists moving forward.
So that's a really interesting point you raise. And I don't want to come back to the Detroit stuff as well, because you were there at the birth of techno, which is one of the reasons why I live in the United States. But mentorship, giving stuff away, all the stuff you've learned. And you are an encyclopedia of not just dance music. You're an encyclopedia of entertainment. And you could write a how-to on every aspect of the business. So why do you give it away so freely?
I learned that it works. And here's also an interesting, here's the way I learned. I was from the Midwest in Detroit. And again, not wanting to be disparaging to anybody at all, in Detroit, Detroit was like the kind of environment where someone's success might count against you. So there wasn't this, let's bring everybody up. If somebody was kind of successful at something, it tended to be like pushing people around, right? And there was one example where I had taken a liberty of sort of using a friend of mine's samples.
Right.
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 And he heard them in a thing that I was working on, and he was livid. And it was like, oh, and then it was like kind of a thing. But I probably was the same way. That was the culture. It's not like this guy was that way. That was sort of like,
sure,
the culture.
I remember that culture back then.
I moved to LA. I remember who it was. It was Ramin Sakura. I moved to LA, and he had one sound that he had for something. And I was like, dude, where'd you get that sound? It's so good. And he's like, oh, shit, you don't have that. Oh, let me give you this from the sample pad. Here, let me give this to you. He gave me like 3 gigs of like his sounds, right? And I was like, what? Right?
Yeah.
That's the way it was out here. It's like, okay. And then that gave me license to be like, all right, well, here's this thing that I have that you don't know. Or contacts were a big one. People were not sharing contacts. The culture in Detroit is just a few people had contacts, and they were usually, pardon me, fucking douchebag lawyers or managers who just knew some people in New York that just latched their hooks into as many kids as they could, right? Out here, oh, shit, you know, why don't you send this to that guy? Oh, no, I'll get here. I'll put you guys in touch right now. Like, that would be,
right.
It would not happen in Detroit.
I remember in London when I was a 17-year-old T-boy in Berwick Street Studios. And this is when programming came out.
Yeah.
It was the death of the Fairlight and the birth of the S900. And I remember these programmers would come in with floppy disks. Remember those?
Yeah.
With kick drums on it. And there were two types. There was the type that would see me drooling over their cases and would say, don't touch my shit. Don't come near it. Huh. And then there was the other ones that would be like, you know what, dude? Copy whatever you want. Just make sure you put the disks back in the same order. They went on to be Nellie Hooper. They went on to be Youth. They went on to be Paul Oakenfold. They went on to be some of the gods of electronic music. And I can't remember who the other guys were.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I do.
It's funny. It's like the more you give it away, it's like it just gets stickier.
Yeah. I just learned. I wasn't raised in that culture.
Me neither.
But I just sort of learned it out here in LA. And it is, I'm absolutely certain that a tenet of nature is that, you know, the more that you give away, if you create this environment of abundance, the more abundance around is the more abundance for you, for everybody around. Just fucking give it away.
Love that, Dennis. I love it.
Unless it's to a record company. Don't give those fuckers any.
Or a manager. So let's talk about, I'm not just going to go straight to the Grammy, because you just have a plethora. You have a library of amazing work spanning, is it 3 decades now?
Mm-hmm.
Shit, man. It's 3 decades.
Can't believe that.
Wow. So what keeps you, because part of being a creative, it's like being married, or it's like having a bad girlfriend. It's a relationship that you just keep going back to, because you get that two or three weekends a year of just the purest romance, but the rest of it is hell. Certainly in my case, it was like the highs, which are everything you touch can't turn to gold by nature. So what keeps your juices going? How do you remain so fresh and so varied and so current? I'm not saying this to kiss your ass. That's what not this is about. No. Your shit sounds as tight now as it did 30 years ago, and it's as current now as it was 30 years ago. How do you do it?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I don't think in those terms. I have no idea. I will say one quick thing, though. You said something, about the relationship between someone's ego and music or being in music and stuff like this. And another great lesson I learned from my mother was do not let what you do for a living define who you are to yourself. The moment you let that happen, you are fucked, because if you get a hit and you think that you're hot shit because you got a hit, the second you don't have a hit, you're going to be right down there like, I'm not hot shit, I suck. You have to really just get in the discipline of being right there in the middle. It's important. There's a book called Peaks and Valleys, which is like almost children's book, but the whole tenet of it is the way that you navigate your peaks determine, you know, how quickly and how deeply your valleys become, and how you navigate your valleys it determines how quickly and high your next peak is going to be. Well, great little book, actually.
I remember we've both seen plenty of people come and go in this past 30 years. I guess I've been doing it 30 years as well. What's on the horizon for you? What's coming up? I really want to drill down on the Grammy, but what's coming up? What's on the horizon for you? Not just musically, on an entrepreneurial level.
Well, I'm excited about my artist development and publishing company, because that gives me the opportunity to interact with some really wonderful new talents. I learn as much or more from them as they from me. I mean, I think the answer to your question is, how is my music current? I think it's the mentoring I do for young producers. I am 100% sure now that that's how I have maintained relevance or sonic. What do you call it? I don't know, being current.
Being now.
I guess. But the point is that, I mentor at these schools and I have an internship program. These kids come in with a completely different set of thinking, where I'm like, how about I shut up now and just watch what they're doing? They're just doing it. They have no fucking idea what they're doing. They're just doing it. Nothing's getting in their way. So it's been amazing for me to just switch up my thinking
I think that's my work with young artists is how.
Okay. So one thing that this was a really tough one for me to grasp, but it didn't help me in the music business because I didn't deploy this technique then, but it has helped me no end. And it's something that I always like to talk about and get my guests' opinion on, which is what I do on a daily basis, whether I'm a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, songwriter, record producer, real estate agent, whatever the hell it is. I get up and I feel that every day is a new script that I am given by Mother Universe, and I work my day as hard as I possibly can in all directions, but I utterly remove myself from expectations.
Yeah, that's important.
What I have found is it's like a trick. When you give it away, when you give up the results, it seems the results seem to take care of themselves. What share on your?
I never had a hit in my life that I planned to have, and I.
That's an important line.
Yeah.
You never had a hit in your life that you plan to have, and you probably plan to have a lot.
And then after you get one, then you plan on having a bunch. I never, ever had a hit that I plan to have after that either, right? So the hits were the ones that were just like haphazard, just came naturally. They were kind of quick. I didn't expect much out of it at all. And those were the ones that were really worked. And then I looked at what worked. And I figured if I do all that same shit again and come with a song that's just as good and do everything the same, I'm going to be able to repeat that success. Never, never even once, ever. So that's like, that's a tricky life lesson to bundle at a TED Talk, right?
Right.
The secret of success in life is to just don't try that hard. Don't try that hard and everything will be fine. I don't know how I haven't found out how to like bundle that into like a little book that people will buy. I don't know.
Seth Godin has, and he calls it shipping date.
Okay, I'm going to check it out.
The shipping date is this. It's beautiful, dude, because I was terrible at this. You're doing a you've got a production you're finishing, right? Yeah. And you say, okay, this shit needs to be done by February 15th. Uh-huh. When February 15th comes, you print that mix regardless of whether it's done.
You know, I love that. And me and Vision were just talking about that very thing at NAMM. We were on a panel about music production, right? And, you know, Richard and I, we know stuff. We've been doing this a long time. And we ended up doing it, like, our bits together. And we were like, let's not talk about how we fucking EQ or compress it. Who fucking cares about that? Here's what you really need to do to know, you know? And imposing limitations on yourself or a structure or something like that. And that was a big one for him. He was like, I will give a song 2.5 days, and then that is fucking it. There's no messing around with this thing for 2 weeks. None of that. Here's another one, because in
2.5 days, love that.
Yeah. And so in, you know, in programming music now, like computers are, you can rock up to 145 tracks without even batting an eye. You don't need 145, right? And Richard said the same thing. He's like, dude, if I'm on track 36, I've gone 8 tracks too far, right? Just keep this shit tight. And it is right. So you really, nowadays, you got to really try to impose your own limitations on yourself, because that compels creativity. Mm-hmm. I don't have 145 tracks to wait for something to sound good. I got 24, and in there, something has to go right. Working with monophonic synthesis has been another big one for me lately. So wow. As a producer, I'll tell you, yeah, this one. So this little thing over here is Pioneer makes this. It's a Dave Smith collaboration with Pioneer called the AS1. It's a beautiful, rich analog monophonic synth, right? And there's a sound on it that I wanted to make a chord with, but it's a monophonic synth. So I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll just play one note at a time. And what I found in building chords one note at a time monophonically is it caused me to be very deliberate with my note selection. Whereas usually, speaking for myself anyway, you go to a keyboard and you're like, this is the chord I know. Bleh. This is the voicing I did. You know what I mean? This is right.
Right.
But if you're doing it one note at a time, you really can do it in a much more compositional way. Much more sort of Mozart-ish.
Yeah, like that's how, what's his name, used to do it? Giorgio Moroder.
Really?
He would make complicated chords by holding one note down per track. And this was...
That's fantastic!
This is when there was no... nothing. It was 2-inch, 24-track, or maybe 16-track.
And no shit.
A room full of wires. And he would hold the note down. Well, what did you think? Let me try the F-sharp. And then he would... That sounded
well,
like,
it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Right. So that, you know, imposing some degree of minimalism on your workflow, I find, compels creativity in ways that you wouldn't see.
That is such an important line. I'm going to say it again. Enforcing minimalism on your creativity. I forgot the line.
It's enforcing, imposing minimalism on your workflow, more or less, right? And how you're working, compels you to be creative. It forces you to.
That is powerful.
Yeah.
Shit, that needs to be on a hat.
But it's right, you know?
It is.
It's got to be a big hat. Like a cat in a hat kind of hat. And then he's going to have to turn around.
So, all right, let's get there. Let's go there. So Dennis is an award winner for me, and has been since before the Grammy. Now, deservedly so. You won the Grammy for the Depeche Mode song, You Move. It's a moment that literally one in a million have in their lives. Would you share it with us?
Well, it's been easier to digest a year later than it was after it happened, because that was quite a thing. So I had only released one piece of music that year under my Detroit project, because I was building this company I was describing to you. Spent most of my time doing that. And this is really one of the neatest life stories I've ever experienced. I still don't know how to bundle it. It's just incredible. Check this out, man. Jason Bentley, friend of mine, KCRW music director, and also a great DJ and a really good producer, music producer himself. He is friendly with the band, and he had an idea for You Move that he pitched on the band. And he also locked in a Detroit remix into the deal. And however it happened, they said, yes. I've interacted with Depeche Mode.
Sure.
throughout the years. I do not mean to imply any of them would know who I was if they saw me. That's not the case. But I have interacted, whether they knew it or not, I've interacted with them throughout the years. And they were big Detroit techno fans. They were in and out of Detroit back in the late 80s, just as Detroit techno fans and stuff, hanging out with Derek, Kevin, and Juan, and those guys. And so he brought me in on this remix. I didn't have any time for it. And I listened through to the acapella, which is what I do when I'm, you know, going to work on something. No music, just the acapella. And that was like, I'm a huge Depeche Mode fan. So I was just listening to Gahan's vocals. Oh, it's so great. And of course, Martin Gore and Fletch. I'm like, all right, let me hear these keyboards now. And listening through it, just part by part by part, the mix kind of composed itself in my brain. I sat down. It took me a day. I did it in like a day. Just knocked the thing.
Wow.
And I sent it over to Jason. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll submit it. The band liked it. Okay, cool. I got paid like a little bit of money. They didn't promo it as a standalone remix. They included that remix on the remix package of 12 remixes for some other song called Going Backwards, I think. And funnily enough, Derek May, Juan Atkins, and Kevin Saunderson did a mix on this package of the other song. So mine was like track 13 in a 12 remix package that no one cares down here. No one heard it, right? No, it didn't. No one heard nothing. So my manager submitted it for remix consideration. I had forgotten about this, and out of the middle of the nowhere, Jason Bentley called me the morning that the nominations, this is like 5 a.m. or something. I'm like, what the hell does Jason Bentley butt dialing me at 5 a.m. for? And he told me that that's what had happened. I was like, wait, what? What? Like that really.
Holy crap.
So now we got Jason in these stories like this. Okay. So it's nominated, and I'm making the most of this nomination because, like, I've got 2 months to not be a Grammy loser. So I'm having parties. I'm shooting press releases. I am hamming it up. There's no way I'm going to win this thing, and I'm comfortable in that. Who was going to win was Adventure Club for their remix of Kalani. It felt like of the moment. They're way bigger than I am. Kalani was having a moment. It was a very chain smokery type of mix, which made a lot of sense to, you know, commercial sensibilities. I thought that was good, right? But nonetheless, you know, I'm going to New York. My family's there. We're going to the thing. And I'll be goddamn if it isn't, you know, my category comes up. And Jace, I didn't write anything. It's just a quick aside.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I didn't write anything. No. My friend Mark Mangini is a sound designer. He won an Oscar for Mad Max. He did Blade Runner 2049. Oh, he is a G. And he said to me, write something, have something prepared just in case. Okay. And then he went on to say, I have a file full of unused acceptance speeches. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I don't want any unused acceptance speeches in my life, in my brain. What a sad moment. I can't deal with it. So I was like, I am not. And I'm not going to win. So I'm fine. Okay. And the voice, when it got to my category that listed the winners, was Jason Bentley.
No!
Jason Bentley now, from getting me this gig, is the voice of the Grammy saying, the nominees are blah, blah, blah. The winner is Dennis White. And it was just so like, first of all, two things happened immediately. Did Jason just tell me, after calling me on the phone and tell me I was nominated, was he the voice of the Grammys that told me I won? So that, I don't know how to bundle that, but that is an unseemly, incredible story to me. So, and then, you know, the other thing that occurred to me was that, oh shit, I didn't have the moment of like, wow, yay, I won, like wondering if it was going to happen.
What do you mean?
I was completely comfortable that Adventure Club were going to win it. And my social media play was going to be filming the thing and they win. And I say, hey, congratulations, you guys. Well done, Bob. That was my social media play. So I'm just like doing this and the guy says my name and I'm like, oh shit.
You were filming the other way?
I was filming the stage.
That's
I'm filming
classic,
the stage, and he
dude.
Says my name, and I'm like, oh, no. I have to go say stuff.
Wow.
So I was like, and before the show starts, Paul Schaefer makes a big deal about the fact we got a lot to get through here. You have 45 seconds between when you hear my name and you got to beat it, right? And all of a sudden, I'm just like clocking down. I'm like, uh-oh. Uh-oh, I got 10 seconds. This is gone.
Oh,
15
God.
Seconds. Now I'm trying to run up to the stage. And I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to say. And I know I need way more than 20 seconds. So I'm like, what do I do here? Oh, I bring Paul into it.
Start talking, hey, I'm on stage with Paul Schaefer. Now I got Paul involved.
Oh, God, that's hilarious.
You're not going to kick me off the... Right? So I just got a little dialogue going with him about something while I'm trying to think of like, what... And I just remember up there, I remember in my brain all this shit that I wanted to say that I thought was going to be really funny, and none of it came out. And I was just up there like, and I had gone on, I'll tell you, this is a true story. The thing I really love doing, I like having a couple of glasses of wine and going on just like a YouTube ADD binge.
We all do.
Okay. I really just let YouTube just let's go. Just bring it to me. And there was, I like old timey kind of stuff that you can really only see on YouTube, like Jack Benny show and Bob Hope shows and those old shows. I just love that stuff. And there was,
that's funny.
I landed on Jack Benny giving, he won something and he made that funny little joke that he made. And I just remembered that. And then from that Jack Benny video, the next thing was, David Letterman wins the Mark Twain Award. So I'm watching this and David Letterman had this amazing thing. He said, so I went up there. All I could do is think of those two guys' speeches. So I just said those speeches, right? I just said those two things. I tried to make sure I gave credit. Like, I wasn't ripping. I was just, okay. Jack Benny said this and David Letterman said this. And thanks very much, everyone. I just scurried off there. And I'm very grateful and humbled by the.
But you also said, which was just delightful. You said the credit shouldn't really be going to you. It should be going to Depeche Mode.
Well, yeah, Jack Benny didn't say that.
Right.
I said that.
You said that, which. Yeah, dude, but come on. You got 30 years clocked up here.
It's okay. Listen, I know where I live in that thing. I'm just glad to be along for the ride. And like my grandfather always used to say, there's no pictures on the scorecard, boy. You know, however you got there is how you got there.
It was just, it was because we see it and I get it. You know, people get, it's like the moment they've waited for their whole lives. You got there, you were funny, and then you gave it away. It was fucking beautiful.
Wasn't mine. I mean, well, that's the good thing. You know,
it was
that's
yours.
That's the nice thing about being 50 at the time when stuff like this happens, right? Now I realize if I'm lucky enough to have any little glimmer of success in doing anything, when you're younger, or when I was anyway, I think it's natural to think, hey, I'm the shit. Yeah, this is about right for me. I'm fucking great. You realize later, no, you're just lucky enough to have found some way to fit into all of this stuff that's floating around you. And, this important thing to realize really where you are in a situation. I find that an asset.
Wow, I could keep talking to this guy forever, man.
It's been a pleasure.
Dennis, you...
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have time for.
You are a love. So if people... Well, I'm going to post all this everywhere anyway. But Static Revenge, whatever. Give all your handles so people can find you. LaTroit, whatever it is.
My artist name is LaTroit now. And just... look for that for a little while.
Yeah, and I'll post everything everywhere, and I'm going to try and get some music, seeing as he owns the publishing, that I can include in the podcast.
Oh, yeah, I got you. I got you, son. One-stop right. Shop.
Bring it in, baby. Love you,
brother.
That was great. Love you. That was awesome.
Good night, everybody.
Coming up next, you'll hear some bonus tracks by the amazing Dennis White, so you just have to do one thing. Turn it up.
With music to my ears to hear your sounds as we venture on through the sea of sheets. I'm in the mood for your poison. Don't try to take it away. I want to let out your wild side and feel those flames. I'm in the mood for your poison. Don't try to take it away. I want to let out your wild side and feel those flames. Turn it around.
can't last forever without your touch. I'm in the mood for your poison. Don't try to take it away. I want to let out your wild side and feel those fangs. I'm in the mood for your poison. Don't try to take it away. I want to let out your wild side and feel those.
That's about it for this week on the podcast. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a comment. But the greatest compliment is when you share the podcast with someone who you think will get something out of it. Big ups to my special guest, Mr. Dennis White. And this is Pete Lorimer signing out from the Creative Entrepreneur Podcast. Until next week, thanks so much for listening.